Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. Some important news right up top. Some of you have already read the Patreon newsletter that I made public, and I'm just going to read a portion of that, because if I do it extemporaneously, I'm going to mess it up and probably lose the thread. Michael Walker had a stroke. He's doing exceptionally well, all things considered, and I'm not going to go into the laborious details, but I will say that he is expected to make a recovery. I've seen him. I was shocked at how much progress he's already made in a scant few days. He remains, as ever, the indomitable, warm, generous, funny, extraordinarily decent man I've had the honor of working with for the past few years. Now, all that said, the road ahead looks long, potentially arduous, but I can imagine few people better equipped with the necessary fortitude. And rest assured, dear listeners, those of you who love Walker in your own way, I will absolutely provide him whatever support I can. And this show is one of those things. We are going to keep the lights running while he's away. Now, to that end, I looked far and wide and then decided that the man who was 2 feet away from me was the best situated to be the first guest host. I would like to introduce you to James DeMoss, a.k.a. Jimbo. How you doing, Jimbo?
Oh, fairly well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, thanks. Some of you may already know Jimbo from our Patreon-exclusive show, Sizzler. Jimbo is one of the few people whose enthusiasm for Spirit Island eclipses my own, and his insight and, quite frankly, melodious tones have enhanced swag for some time, and he very generously agreed to step up to the plate. There are going to be other guest hosts going forward. I'm, in fact, very pleased and gratified at the number of people who've agreed to help us out, and I think you're going to be pleased with what they put out. They're certainly going to do a better job than I do. And thus, the near future of swag looks as bright as could be expected, given that it has already lost its number one co-host. So, with that in mind, we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. We're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And the topic is when to go digital. And then we are going to get out of here. So, first off, the Eurus is Planet Unknown. Jimbo, you've played Planet Unknown. What are your thoughts?
I have. Planet Unknown is one of those games that, on the surface, I might have looked at as seeming perhaps overly gimmicky with the Lazy Susan in the middle, but that maybe even only a round into I just totally fell in love with. I'm absolutely awful at it. I end up spending all of my time trying to fill in my planet as opposed to fill in my planet intelligently in ways that get me points. But I really, really enjoy Planet Unknown. It's one of those games that anytime people suggest it, I'm always happy to support. Be like, yeah, let's do that.
Planet Unknown, to my mind, represents some of the best and worst of the hobby. It's some of the best in the hobby in that it scales really well, plays very quickly, has a really engaging theme. And the theme kind of sort of makes a little bit of sense when you ignore the tiles dropping from the sky part. Other than that, the theme is okay. It's got a lot of variety, a lot of visual appeal, a lot of tactile appeal, and is very approachable for people who don't really like a whole lot of daunting rule stuff. Now, that having been said, there are some weird rules interactions that don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. A lot of the variety content is a bit dodgy. Like, we've played with the alternate corpse every time, and yeah, they're okay.
Yeah.
But the alternate planets, especially in conjunction with the alternate corpse...
Yeah, there are some strange interactions and some unclear or ambiguous interactions, and that's always a little frustrating.
And the imbalance is palpable. Like, we're not going to sit there. We're not going to sit there and try to second guess designers too much. But some of the alternate planets look like straight advantages, and some of them look like crippling disadvantages.
So absolutely,
we're not experts, but it looks that way. And also, more to the point, this is a very player count flexible, very approachable light game that is huge and costs $1 billion. And for hardcore hobbyists, that's a bit of a trap, right? So if I would compare it just off the top of my head to a game like, say, Whale Riders, mm-hmm, which is comparably good at scaling, comparably good in terms of variety and weird and interesting things that could happen in some ways but not in others, I would much rather a smaller box game like Whale Riders that of that form than Planet Unknown. That having been said, since we reviewed it, we have kept Planet Unknown in the rotation. It's a useful game to have in the rotation.
Absolutely.
When you're game daddy like I am.
But as a gaming group, it might be difficult for anyone to be willing to shell out for a game of that size, of its relative simplicity. Again, not to say that it's overly simplistic or that it's a game for babies, but...
I don't know who would say such a thing about a game.
I can't imagine. No, I don't think anybody would say. It's just far too snooty a response. But so perhaps that's the kind of thing, it's the kind of game that maybe an entire group might get together and shell out for.
Yeah.
But I do definitely think that the opening price tag combined with its accessibility makes it a strange kind of dichotomy.
Yeah, kind of like, it's not as bad as Foundations of Rome, but no. A little bit like Foundations of Rome. Of course, I like Planet Unknown a lot more than Foundations of Rome. There is a new expansion coming up. I'm a sucker. I think I pledged for it. Well, there'll be more content about Planet Unknown.
I'm excited for the expansion, so I guess we're both suckers.
Yeah. You didn't have to pay for it, and you don't have to lug it anywhere, Jimbo.
What?
So Planet Unknown remains in the rotation. Very pleased with it, even though the level of content is uneven. What can I say? Crowdfunding. And part of me wonders how sustainable this kind of niche is. You know, very, very approachable. Borderline family weight game that is huge and expensive. But happy to have it. Don't know that I can justify it. So that's the Ayuris, what we reviewed last year. Now on to the games that we played last week. I will get started. I played Skytear Horde Monoliths. Skytear Horde is a solo or co-op with a competitive version that I've not tried but looks very dodgy. Kind of lane defense-y, deck construction, magic kind of combat thing within striking distance of Hearthstone kind of deal. And it's super derivative. In point of fact, a friend of the show, Efka Bladukas, basically ragged on it as being so incredibly derivative. But that, although a knock against it, isn't enough to keep me from enjoying it. And Monoliths is the first wave of expansion material. There have been three campaigns. One of them is ongoing now, which is actually just called Skytear Horde Campaigns. And I'm taking a big miss on that. For those of you that listened to Pledge of Indifference, I talked about how Campaigns is A, a campaign system that I'm not particularly interested in, and B, the pricing on Skytear Horde is just getting so ridiculous. It's 60 euros for a bunch of cards, and then a whole bunch more for shipping on top of that.
Oof.
I just can't justify that anymore, frankly. And with Monoliths, that I probably also overpaid for, frankly, I have 8 faction decks, a whole bunch of monster factions, endless number of castles, so I've gotten more than enough content to get going. But as I frequently say with respect to solo games, I want it to have a relatively minimalist footprint, I want it to be quick to set up, and I don't want a whole lot of overhead. And Skytear Horde absolutely ticks all of those boxes. I'm vaguely inclined to give the co-op another shot, maybe. The problem is that the card draw in Skytear Horde is deliberately very circumspect. You have to defeat something in order to draw a card. And the universe of opportunities to draw cards does not double when you add a second player.
And
yeah, so the one time I played with Walker, Jimbo, for context, he very strongly felt like there just flatly wasn't enough card draw in the game. And I could see where he was coming from, because usually, you know, the solo game card draw is rare, and then multiplayer, it was just vanishingly rare. Again, the competitive version doesn't look very interesting. I mean, the automated deck just flips over enemies for you to fight, and I can't imagine having to, like, manage resources to flip over a small number of enemies is particularly satisfying. That having been said, if someone really wanted to try it, I'd try it. But Skytear Horde Monoliths fulfilled in Canada very recently, and so I got it to the table very quickly after that, after consolidating the components. I will say that the paper, the sheet in the box telling you how to consolidate everything was vanishingly short on detail.
Oh, no.
It was just very sort of like, yeah, just, you know, the cards go where they go. It was honestly to the point where I might have preferred that they didn't have a sheet at all. Like, nothing physically in the box, because I tried to follow it. And then, I quickly, in the first paragraph, I ran into some trouble I couldn't resolve. I go on BoardGameGeek, and I see that there was an update with a much better version of how to integrate things. And I go there, and I check that document. It's about 4 times as long, and it's actually detailed. And that I followed, and everything was fine.
So the piece of paper might as well have said, please go to this website and view our updated document.
Yeah, man, QR codes are back. They're making a huge comeback. They could have just included a huge QR code with no context. I would have scanned it, probably. So pro tip, if you need to consolidate Skytear Horde, don't bother with the piece of paper. Go check the updated version. It will help you out. So that is Skytear Horde Monoliths, an expansion of Skytear Horde, designed by Giacomo Neri and Riccardo Neri, published by Skytear Games. Easy to remember publisher.
This week, I had a chance to play Mythwind. It's a game that Walker got in some time ago. I find it difficult to explain. If it were a video game, I would describe it as a solo cozy game. This is a 1-4 player settlement construction-ish game where you're out in the middle of fairy woods and you're putting together your entire new settlement. But the actual putting together of the settlement seems to take a bit of a backseat to each character's unique mechanics. In this case, Walker was playing the farmer and I was playing the explorer slash hunter. It seems like the game mostly focuses on each individual mini game, which then sort of slowly feeds into the main game. I don't know exactly how long it takes for the settlement to sort of begin to grow and flourish. It has a very interesting weather and season mechanic that I thought was neat. There's a what I would consider to be a frustrating lack of stakes. There is, for example, an end goal for the season. We didn't meet our end goal for fall. So presumably we're all going to starve to death when winter comes along.
Based on the vibe of the game, I doubt it.
Yeah, no. In actuality, if I remember correctly, there was no penalty for missing the... and that's if that's what you're looking for, that's great. The art is quite charming. The storytelling, particularly about the different fairy spirits that you might encounter in the woods and how they begin to contribute to your settlement construction is also quite charming. But for me, at least, although it was an enjoyable overall experience, it just sort of... lacked any kind of pressing anything. That sounds terrible because the game is full of content. There's events, there's adventures, there's buildings to build, there's new seasons, there's charming miniatures. But I guess what I meant is consequences. It seems very much like you're doing things to continue to do things. Now that I'm talking about it out loud, I sort of remember what it's like to be an endgame raider in any kind of MMO where, you know, I raid to get the gear. Okay, what do you do with the gear? Well, I raid with it. It seems very much like it. You build up your individual mechanics and you contribute to the settlement so that you can continue to build up your individual mechanics and contribute to the settlement. And again, if that's what you're looking for, then I can heartily recommend Mythwind because it captures that cozy vibe quite well. On the other hand, if that's not really your thing, you probably want to give it a pass.
Cozy does indeed seem to be the watchword. The crowdfunding page was replete with the word cozy. And so at least they satisfied their design remit, at least. We get to try Slay the Spire, the board game. This is the adaptation of the card game on the PC into a card game on your table. And so cards all the way down. This was done by Gary Dworetsky at Contention Games. This is the same publisher that put out Imperium the Contention. No, not that Imperium. No, not that Imperium. That other Imperium. And we played through two acts. It's the kind of structure where it's a three-act game, but every act is a session unto itself that can take roughly 45 to 90 minutes, I'd say, case depending. And so doing all three acts in a single sitting is a bit of a lift, but we did two individual sessions separated by a couple days. What were your impressions of Slay of the Spire, the board game, Jimbo?
So during the first stage, I think I was comparing it too much to the video game because it seemed a touch slow.
Well, it begs the comparison.
Before you quite accurately pointed out that perhaps compared to the video game, it's slow, but compared to most co-op, I'm using quotation marks, dungeon crawlers. Because it's not quite a dungeon crawler.
Right.
It's actually extremely quick. And once we started playing the second session, I definitely started to feel that, where the game started to flow a bit better, at least in my perception. I quite enjoyed Slay the Spire. As an avid video gamer, I am frequently one of the first to poo-poo video game to board game, or in some cases, the first to eagerly ask my friend to back it and then discover that it was not very good all along. Darkest Dungeon. But Slay the Spire surprised me in the way that it managed to both capture the essence and the feel of Slay the Spire while also managing to be just a fun board game to play with your friends. I don't know that playing it solo would be a worthwhile experience compared to the game. Although, again, if you're not much for video games, then maybe it will still scratch that itch. Particularly the multiplayer component really felt extremely well done.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm going to be playing it a little bit more as time goes on. I've got some unresolved thoughts. I agree with you that in terms of an adaptation, it is very successful. Part of me still wonders if it is the answer to the question that no one asked. But as a work of design rebalancing and of adaptation, I think it's very impressive. And how much payoff that gets you, I am still not 100% sure, but I have every intention to try to find out. And so we'll probably end up playing Act 3 at some point.
I'm looking forward to it.
And failing that, and in addition to that, I'll probably try some of the other characters as well.
So without additional unlocks, I'm looking forward to getting immediately pantsed by the Act 3 boss, just like the very first time that one gets to the third floor in Slay the Spire.
Indeed. So that are the continuing thoughts on Slay the Spire, the board game.
We also had a chance to sit down and play a couple rounds of Sentinels of the Multiverse, which is a perennial favorite when it comes to co-op games. I was going to say it's quick, but now that it takes up an obelisk, the physical drain on those who have to bring it, be it Mark or Walker, is considerable, because there are so many villains and so many heroes. And but I part of the thing I love about it, of course, is just that huge amount of flexibility. And in Oblivion, they hooked me directly with the here are some villains that used to be your enemies that are now your allies. The trope that always manages to hook me.
Sentinels of the Multiverse came up very prominently in our discussion of games that are difficult to transport but are worth it. And what was happening was the context was we were going to be five players of varying degrees of facility with board games, and people were in the mood for co-op. And I realized that five-player co-ops, I don't have a whole heck of a lot. And I also know independently that everyone loves Sentinels. I wasn't specifically avoiding Sentinels. It's not the first thing I'm going to go to when I have to bring it somewhere. And indeed, I have the all-in box. It's massive. It's huge. And part of me just wonders, this is an irrational fear because so far it hasn't manifest. Every time I have to move a box that size, I'm convinced it's just going to tumble apart under its own weight.
Absolutely. Kudos to the design team for putting it together, because both copies of the monolith that I've seen have held together. But I can definitely see that every time you move it, there would be that fear, as this where something tears along a critical point and just the whole thing dumps onto the floor.
Yeah, and I remember reading the engineering updates and in the Kickstarter updates. They're like, we made a terrible mistake saying we were going to do this. Oh, no.
Oh, no. What were we thinking?
And a variety of other publishers have done the exact same thing. So as you said, we played two sessions back to back. I'm seldom willing to do such a thing for a game, but we proceeded very, very quickly because the two bosses came up and we pantsed them.
Yeah, so our first boss was Choke Point, who had a faint memory as being a bit of a pushover, and that turned out to be pretty much true. At no point, I don't think, did Choke Point really have any measurable offense. There were definitely moments of, oh, well, that's inconvenient.
Yeah, exactly.
when they stole our gear or snatched the top card of our deck. But poor Choke Point got pretty run over, and then as a follow-up, we randomed up Deadline. And by virtue of the fact that we of our particular hero distribution, we just absolutely pantsed Deadline. At no point did he have anything approaching a measurable offense. It was just one of those things. So Deadline, for those who haven't played, wants to get three of his special Cataclysm cards into play. They are also tagged ongoing cards. One of the players at the table was playing Nightmist, who has a card that can remove potentially up to four ongoing and environment cards from the table. And so the first two or three times that Deadline managed to get up to the three on his bonus card play, which means he'd have to wait a turn to trigger his ability, Nightmist swept the board. Then once Nightmist had used both or all three of the copies of that card that were in their deck, the rest of us were in a position to begin flicking one or two away on our turns, and basically just dead. There was a point where his auto armor caster came out where we couldn't damage him directly, where I'm certain he, you know, the hypothetical Deadline thought to himself, okay, it's been rough until now, but I've got the armor caster and now things are only going to be looking up. They didn't look up. It just didn't work out for poor Deadline.
I think both of these boss encounters highlight the extent to which Sentinels of the Multiverse is a very, very fragile design, because both Choke Point and Deadline are going to be difficult precisely in proportion to what specific kinds of heroes you bring. Not the specific heroes, but kinds of heroes.
Indeed.
So if you rely on equipment, if you bring Wraith, a.k.a. not Batman, or Bunker, a.k.a. not Iron Man, or Absolute Zero, a.k.a. not Iceman, Choke Point will ruin you.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Because those characters only get going by putting out a whole bunch of equipment. And the point is, again, this is not a difficulty observation. I really like difficult games. I like pushover games, too. But the problem is that in Sentinels of the Multiverse, if your character only works with specific cards out and the villain keeps taking them, it's not fun. You cannot get going. You can't feel like you're contributing anything. You've got a whole bunch of dead cards, and the only way to get to... You figure, well, maybe now they haven't removed equipment for three whole turns. Maybe I'm... Oh, no, it's gone.
Oh, there it is.
My turn was wasted. And so we all had, like, a reasonably good time just completely smacking Choke Point around like they stole something. But and then same story with Deadline. Deadline, getting rid of ongoing cards is usually hard. And I remember thinking I had a couple of cards that could do it. It's like, oh, okay, well, this will definitely slow him down a bit. And then meanwhile, a couple seats over, someone says, this card says I could get rid of maybe only two ongoing cards at once. Is that going to be good? And we were like, Yeah, that will ruin his deck.
Yeah,
forever.
Exactly. That will be tremendous against this particular villain.
Maybe just two will be just fine. And again, it was enjoyable, but I think it really highlights the extent to which Sentinels of the Multiverse is theme first, experience first, and design much, much second. I don't know if the revised version has really ameliorated this. It doesn't look like it.
We should say this is the 1.0 or 1. Whatever version. This is not the revised edition. So,
well, it was the revised edition, just not the newest revised edition. It's a long story.
and also, actually, in perfect interest of transparency, we did have in all cases two of the Oblivion heroes.
That is true.
Three in the second game. Who all tend to have a fairly significant power creep advantage over earlier heroes. We had Writhe as a solo hero in both games. We had Harpy as a solo hero. Sorry, Harpy in the first game. And then in the second game, we still had Writhe. We had the Idealist solo hero. And we had Variant Skyscraper, all of whom are Oblivion characters.
So I don't think Skyscraper quite runs afoul of that. In your hands, I think she does. She's one of your favorites, and so you play her all the time.
Absolutely.
I definitely agree with the Idealist. I think the Idealist is flatly one of the stronger heroes.
Cough, karate robot, cough.
Exactly. But the cards are so charming that it's great. The Idealist, for those who haven't played, is basically a preteen girl with projection and telepathic-based mental powers. And so she makes these projections that all the other, like, grown-up stern heroes under just flatly don't understand. And one of them is Karate Robot. And so the flavor text on Karate Robot is one of the other heroes saying, do you really have to make those sound effects every time it does anything? And it's just stuff like that all the way down. It's one of the reasons why I like playing as her so much. But the more I think about it, the more I think about the overall arc of the power in Heroes of the Sentinels of the Multiverse is kind of like a sort of a big U. Because I keep thinking, oh yeah, they got more powerful later on. I think that's just Oblivion wielding an outside influence. And I keep forgetting that in the base set, you have Legacy and Wraith. And any set with Legacy and Wraith cannot be a set of underpowered heroes.
It's true.
Not all of them are that good. But, again, if you're playing Wraith, unless you're playing a character that nukes equipment all the time.
Yes, absolutely.
But those are important provisos. Whatever. As I say, you know, if you want balance, if you want a predictable gameplay experience, if you want a solid core gameplay loop, don't play Sentinels of the Multiverse.
But if you want a very enjoyable superhero cooperative game, then absolutely play Sentinels of the Multiverse.
Definitely. If you like playing cards just to see what happens, Sentinels is your game.
I had a chance to get Marshmallow Test back to the table. A friend of mine is a fan of trick-taking games. It was actually him who first taught me how to play Wizard. And so I had brought Marshmallow Test out to his place. And it was a good success. I'm a big fan of Marshmallow Test. I like trick-taking games, although I'm of low to middling success at them. But I really like Marshmallow Test's, do I go out early and just get guaranteed points and not risk going out last, or do I hang in and try to scrimp a few extra points? The thrust of Marshmallow Test, for those who haven't played, is that when you go out, you get points equal to the number of tricks that the other players have taken, except for the last player who gets nothing. You get nothing. Good day, sir. And so particularly when it comes down to the last two, there's this very tense sort of exchange of back and forthing. And at least in the first game, one of the new players, the experienced trick taker, internalized that very quickly and thoroughly pants the other three of us. The second game was more even. Overall, I still like Marshmallow Test, a very enjoyable trick taking game. You've had a chance to play Marshmallow Test with us before, haven't you?
I have. And the thing that I find fascinating about Marshmallow Test is that it really highlights one of those things that comes up in other trick-taking games but doesn't take pride of place, which is the transition from I don't want to be leading tricks / I don't want to be winning tricks to, okay, now I really need to start winning them. Because a lot of trick-taking games, they fall into a rhythm of somebody takes the lead and holds on to it, or never wants the lead and never takes it. In Marshmallow Test, everyone is expected at some point to make that kind of key transition. You cannot just run the table for a whole bunch of tricks at once. And by a whole bunch, I mean like three or four, mm-hmm. because then you're out. If that happens when you want it to, that's great. If you can turn it on and then hold it, that's fine. But it's very difficult to do that. And one of the things that I really appreciate about Marshmallow Test is that there's a horde of really interesting trick-taking games. Ghosts of Christmas, Trick Takers, Kings, you name it. But Marshmallow Test is by far one of the cleanest. You know, they all tend to have some number of central gimmicks. And a lot of them end up being borderline obtuse at times. But unsurprisingly from a Reiner Knizia game, Marshmallow Test's core scoring gimmick is super transparent, and the pressures that it puts on people, how to execute those pressures is not clear, but the pressures that it puts on you are very, very clear. And so that's one of the reasons why I think it's so well done and so immediately approachable.
Yeah, absolutely. I introduced it. It was the first time for three of the four players at the table, basically everyone who wasn't myself. And I think it was well received.
It doesn't hurt that it has nice squishy marshmallows.
Yes, I did have to tell one of the players immediately the minute the marshmallows hit the table, these are not edible.
You could have instead told them that they could chew on them now, or if they waited, they could chew on real marshmallows.
Exactly. See that? I missed a chance. I missed a chance.
Have you seen the launch video for Marshmallow Test?
I have not.
It's bizarre. It is Dr. Reiner Knizia in the world's worst drag explaining the marshmallow test. It's so strange.
Well, I'm going to have to track that down and see it.
I've seen it about three or four times. I still don't know what to make of it. It's a scene.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
I'm amazed, but I don't know what to make of it.
Amazed, but at the scene.
Yeah. So we played Primal the Awakenings. This is the latest huge box full of miniatures that I pledged for on a whim. I tend to do this about once or twice a year, and I often expect it to turn out terribly. It's definitely not turned out terribly. This is published by Reggie Games. One of the reasons why I chose to pledge for this giant box of miniatures as opposed to the many other terrible-looking box of miniatures that are available is because Reggie Games put out a game called Elo Darkness a few years ago, which is a two-player mobile-like thing that is extremely weird but interesting in a number of key areas. And so I figured Primal the Awakening might be okay. Primal the Awakening is basically Kingdom Death Monster or Monster Hunter or whatever. It's a boss battler. You tear the body apart. You get bits. Use the bits to make other things. The aesthetic is definitely more reminiscent of Monster Hunter, though, in that the weapons and armor are very clearly animal bits that less refined or they don't look like real world weapons, suffice to say. I get a very strong Monster Hunter vibe from the aesthetic of things. And we played the tutorial, where I messed up a rule really badly, but it served the use of the tutorial. And I noticed this because in our second session, I couldn't help but notice that we were very much leaning in to some of the gameplay elements. Mm-hmm. Was that your observation as well?
Absolutely. I definitely found that our second play of Primal, we were very much leaning into some of the gameplay elements, the discussions of assist cards going around the table. And particularly one of the things I noticed is that we all seemed to have a much better grasp of each individual class's how they functioned. There were at least two, if not three, oh, I think I get it nows, as we played against our second monster. I've been really enjoying Primal. At first, I was a bit confused by it, partially by virtue of the rule we got wrong, but also partially because it has the monster fights, as Mark mentioned, from Kingdom Death Monster, but it doesn't have the fun building up your village mechanics. But on the flip side, it also doesn't have the obnoxious random roll hunt mechanics.
Right.
So I think I was still trying to figure out exactly where I fell in that particular distribution about, which of these, which am I missing this more than I am preferring this? But I really like the just set up, get down to it, make it happen. Both monsters have felt different enough so far, I think.
Yeah, so there's definitely an effort towards minimalism in some of the areas of Primal that I appreciate. So the monster board, actually, when you're fighting the monster, the main board, it looks an awful lot like how Dark Souls did its boss fights.
Very much so.
Divvied up, it's a circle, monsters in the middle, four quadrants, that's it. And you're right, there's no community building. There's a little bit of paperwork in that you track what resources you have, and you spend those resources to get various upgrades. But it's not like you're drowning in a whole bunch of different options. There are just, at the moment, there are only two boards where you can spend things. I expect that's going to multiply. The key objection I have to the campaign elements, and it's worth noting that there are a lot of one-off scenarios if you just want to go and fight monsters. And I appreciate that. I haven't looked too much about how much upkeep they have or how much setup is involved. Is that there's a lot of background flavor text that I'm just glossing over entirely. I haven't gotten a whole lot of value out of them. I don't know how much value any of you guys would get out of them because I'm not inclined to pass the book around for everyone to read it four times, nor am I inclined to read them because it's really just huge blocks of text. It's more or less, look, my gloss on it, as I say, is you mostly just have reason to go out and kill things. It's like, oh, these archaeologists disappeared. Go try to find them. Oh, we're attacked by a monster. Kill the monster. Take its stuff. All right, fine. as an excuse to hang a gameplay loop together, it's fine, but there's just too much of it. I'm not feeling it.
It definitely seems to have played into your campaign fatigue.
Well, it's weird because I was contrasting it with the narrative of Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan, which did grab me right away. There's less text and it's more to the point as opposed to Primal, where there's more of it and less of it really serves to sell much of anything.
That's fair. Yeah. No, I can definitely, by comparison, no, you're definitely quite right.
That's just my impression though. Other people might have a different impression of the setting in the world. And so the fundamental driver of how the combat works is making card combos. You've got this deck of cards, you have a certain degree of customization options available that will increase as time goes on. And a lot of cards care about whether they were played after a certain kind of card or in conjunction with a certain kind of card or played at the right location next to a monster. And that part is really cool. That part of just playing out your hand and figuring out a way to maximize your effect, marshal your resources, I think is really well done. I don't know how much I'm enjoying that if I'm enjoying that to the extent that it justifies all the rest of the stuff around it. Every monster's got its own set of cards, its own set of rules. Every monster has its own set of effects. The keywords are a borderline nightmare. What's the difference between dazed and stun and fatigue? It's like, okay, look, all these three things mean the same. Is there a reference sheet? No. Why would there be a reference sheet? The rule book is a 90-page tome that has the tutorial and then the full game context and then the actual rules and then the glossary and then the index. Like, come on, split these documents up, please, guys. I'm referring to it all the time. It is so bad that there will be these gameplay effects. And then two turns later, the same effect would recur, and nobody at the table remembers how the effect works.
Absolutely.
That's not okay.
No, and not having a rule sheet makes having to look up these particular mechanics quite aggravating.
Yes. None of it is particularly complicated. None of it is particularly baroque. None of it has a huge amount of overhead. But in conjunction, all these things together serve to attenuate the cool combat elements and honestly make me a little less jazzed. So I've enjoyed the two plays. The rest of the people involved want to keep playing, and that's okay. I will. Part of me wonders whether A, I'd be more into it if I was more into the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
B, if I would be more into it if there was a better ease of splitting up the overhead. But again, there's only one central rules document. All the monster stuff is contained in one set of different decks of cards, and so it's not easily parsed. Anyway, so. Again, given my general disinterest towards campaigns, the fact that I'm willing to continue with Primal the Awakening is some degree of praise, but it's not... I wish it focused more on the cool card play elements. I also think the downtime is a bit of a problem.
It is, unfortunately. One of the things that I had is that, so whenever you play... When you play cards, some of your cards may have a symbol in the upper right corner that tells you whether or not you've gained aggro, whether you have the monster's attention. Whoever has aggro last becomes the first player for the next turn. This, unfortunately, can result in strange corner cases where someone starts a turn as the first player and then is the last player of the next turn, meaning they have to sit through 6 to 7 full turns before they act again. And now, there are small things that can mitigate this, cards you can jump in with, you know, oh, you took away some of the monster's struggle, I'm going to double that, or you need to draw cards, I'm going to give you an assist, that help a little bit, but they also then serve to blunt your own turn when it does finally come around, because now you have less cards. One of the central conceits of the game is that you have to discard cards to pay the stamina to play for cards, meaning you're very infrequently playing more than a certain amount of cards in a turn. And if you've already played some of those cards to help other people's turns to try to get rid of, mitigate some of the incredible downtime, then it can feel like you waited a long time to do very little.
On top of that, the second monster we fought, one of its key tools in its toolbox was causing people to discard cards. It wasn't skip a turn, but it was getting close.
It was getting there. Yeah. It was definitely one of those mechanics that kind of made my jaw tighten and my, you know.
I agree with you that the ability to support other people on their turns in Primal is good, but the ratio of that to gameplay is not nearly as good as something else, like, for example, even Sentinels of the Multiverse, or Street Masters is another example I would give. There's a far greater sense of I'm supporting people, and therefore more back and forth of what's going on in the turn, and a degree of coordination. It's not multiplayer solitaire, that's for sure.
No, it's definitely not.
You don't completely ignore what someone's doing on their turn, but most of the time, I mostly felt that I was just watching along as someone was building up their huge combo to do massive quantities of damage, which is satisfying, but doesn't really alleviate the downtime as much as I would like.
It also, in my opinion, doesn't help that the character that you chose, while incredibly useful, the main tank character, hasn't yet seemed to have developed the same kind of card-playing combo interests that, for example, my greatsword character, Louis's greatbow character, other Louis's hammer character, which I'm imagining doesn't contribute particularly well to that sense of, okay, well, it's my turn, but so what?
No, I was reasonably satisfied with what I was able to pull off. I mostly feel like the card combos that are built into my character class didn't really manifest just because my card draw was weird. So gotcha. Just as an example, one of the things in Primal the Awakening that's really cool is you start with a mastery card and you have to do a certain trick 1 to 3 times over the course of the game to unlock the mastery card. And now you get this real big boost to your special ability and even a boost to how some of your normal cards work. And the way my character does that is by playing a yellow card followed by a red card in immediate succession. All my yellow cards were at the top of the deck and all my red cards were at the bottom of the deck. Oof. It happens.
Yeah.
Now, if I'd really wanted to lean into activating that ability, I could have held on to more yellow cards. But the thing is that, again, in my character's case, yellow cards are super useful. It's what he likes to do. And so I just played them out and whatever. As I say, it was only a minor thing. My character had a number of cards that were interesting and indeed kind of mitigated the turn order issue that I identified. For example, he has 2 different cards in his starting deck that say, while this card is on the top of your discard pile, other characters' attacks get buffed. That was super neat. We even were able to do it half by accident, where I played that card out and then I was last in turn order the next round, and so it stayed on the top of my discard for even longer. There were a couple of occasions where I could discard a card to do something off turn, but I chose not to, specifically so as to keep that at the top. That's neat. I mean, there's some good design work going
Absolutely.
On here in Primal Awakening, far more than I would have expected on a campaign that got by on, look at this giant miniature of a dragon! Not to say that wasn't at least part of why I pledged for it. But as I say, at the moment, I'm not, it's kind of on the bubble for me as to how much I want to give into Primal the Awakening. But I'm willing to go along for the ride for now, and that's flatly more than I expected.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair.
So that's Primal the Awakening by Tommaso Mondadori and Alberto Barisi, published by Reggie Games, recently fulfilled pursuant to successful crowdfunding.
I also had a chance to get Oak back to the table. Oak is a worker placement game where you are playing druids who split their time between traveling to different shrines to invoke different effects and climbing up a giant tree to then crawl out on the branches and live there forever. It gets a little muddy in that part.
Is that what's going on?
That's when you... Yeah, it's... The trees, things are a little unclear in the tree.
Where's Susan? She climbed up the tree. She's not coming back.
Yeah, I think the tree might be a distant relative to Steel Space.
Okay.
I'm not certain. But it's a relatively simple-ish, but with enough going on to keep, I think, even hobbyist gamers interested. It's a decent weight, medium weight, I would say, for getting people into the game. It was fairly well received. Always one of the things that gets people, and I'm sure this is one of the reasons that we pledged for it in the first place, is that when you can have your druids go and become special archdruids. And when you become an archdruid, you take this little piece of rubber that's maybe a hood or a bag or a lute or a raven and you put it onto the miniature and it hooks on, and now your druid is a cool druid for the rest of the game. And
it's amazing.
It's very fun. Yeah.
More Euros should have physical gimmicks.
I agree.
Because there's no reason why you can't have a toy factor in your Euro.
Precisely. I can only remember a Seismic's giant rocket that you slowly assemble. If in any number of Euros where I'm, you know, making a rocket to go to the moon, if I get to actually slot... You know,
right.
Pieces of the rocket into the scaffolding. I'm sold.
Yeah, sold. It's true. That's a good point. Yeah, Oak has had surprising legs. It's been very well received. You're right that the fundamental core mechanisms are not terribly daunting, but there's a fair amount going on, and it's very satisfying to manage your card flow and manage your druids and play dress up with little tiny action figures.
Yes, exactly. Each druid starting board gives you a bit of a different kind of starting advantage. You know, this is the faction that focuses on advanced druids. This is the faction that focuses on monsters, etc. That gives you a chance to sort of change things up. Just an overall fun middleweight worker placement Euro. I'm also having a chance to play an online game of Gaia Project. Warm Boy had expressed some interest in being able to play, and it's a favorite of Walker's and mine, so we started up a game. I struggle, actually, to put Gaia Project in a niche. I'm sure Mark can better for me.
No, I can't.
Oh, well, there you go. It's sort of a action selection kind of 3X-y game. It's
Whenever I use the term action selection to describe a game in terms of genre, I know I've got nothing better.
that's exactly it. For those who played Terra Mystica, very similar. The salient difference is the Gaia forming, the titular Gaia forming, where you will take certain void planets and you will convert them to Gaia planets. And then ideally you will live on those Gaia planets. You're putting down buildings and then upgrading those buildings to do things. I quite enjoy it. The downtime can be kind of significant.
Mm-hmm.
Again, similar to what we said in Primal, it's somewhat mitigated by an energy charging mechanic where when other players build or upgrade buildings near you, you get to cycle power, which will then let you do things. But it is a mild mitigation rather than a completely take the sting out of somewhat longer turns. I am a little concerned, having played a decent amount of Gaia Project, that the end game may always feel the same. I'm keeping a particular eye this time to see if it shakes out differently, but I've identified certain things, such as saving your QICs so that you can spend them to hit your Federation tokens over and over again to score mm-hmm. more and more points. It seems like that's always, and now maybe that's purely just how we end up playing. Perhaps that's not the result of the game state, but it does unfortunately seem like the end state of Gaia Project tends to be fairly samey.
I've played this system in four different games now: Terra Mystica, Gaia Project, Terra Nova, and Age of Innovation. And one of the things that means that I kind of enjoy it, but I never really fully get into it, is precisely that. I feel like every game more or less has the same arc. And it's not really even much of an arc. It's just, this turn I build as many buildings as I can, but next turn I'm going to build as many buildings as I can. And sometimes, this is not true of all of them, and this is a gross generalization across four different games, but often I feel as though the asymmetric player powers don't give you more freedom for variety. They just say, well, this is the development path you should be pursuing. And that doesn't really lean into its strengths.
I actually completely agree. I find that the individual player powers less give you more options and more pigeonhole you into what is clearly an optimal route. Now, you're still free to ignore that particular route,
right?
But then you might as well just be playing with one of the basic factions.
Sure. Did you just call me basic?
I did.
Okay.
Because you're basic.
So those are the games we played last week. Now we're going to take a brief break to pay some bills. Going online without ExpressVPN is like not having a case for your phone. Most of the time, you'll probably be fine, but all it takes is one drop and you'll wish you'd spent those extra few dollars on a case. Whenever you connect to a public network, like a restaurant or an airport, your private information is not secure. It only takes some cheap hardware and a small amount of knowledge to intercept whatever you're doing. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data. ExpressVPN has the security to give you peace of mind. It would take some serious tech over a billion years to get through ExpressVPN's encryption. And it's extremely easy to use and works on all kinds of devices. I was on the road recently, and I had to do a lot of work on unfamiliar networks. And since I use ExpressVPN, I didn't have to worry about having my personal info being stolen and sold. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/sowronggames. That's expressvpn.com/sowronggames, and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/sowronggames.
Innovative materials, unexpected colorways, and fresh, clean styles that rise above trends. That's how Movement designs their California modern watches. And to celebrate their 11-year anniversary, they're having a huge site-wide sale with up to 60% off site-wide. From Movement bestsellers like smooth ceramics and automatics to other new arrivals, save big during Movement's anniversary sale. Shop now for up to 60% off site-wide at Movement.com. That's MVMT.com.
And we're back. Now moving on to the news and why it doesn't matter. Before we get into that, let us just address something that does matter. I just want to thank everyone for the outpouring of support. I've been relaying the messages of support to Michael Walker in his time of recovery. We really do appreciate it. This community and this group of listeners is really amazing. I feel like I don't deserve it. And I've been very, very touched, even while being overwhelmed with having to deal with all the contingencies in place. But I sincerely appreciate it. I haven't been getting back to nearly as many people as I would like to. Please know that I have heard you, and thank you very much. Now, sad news. Shapeways has filed for bankruptcy. They ceased operations a few days ago, and now they're not...
Oh, no.
Yeah. Now, this is sad news for, of course, everyone associated with Shapeways. They were the largest print-on-demand service in the world. And on top of that, though, a number of independent operators have been left in the lurch. There was a non-trivial number of people, particularly in the tabletop miniatures game space, who used Shapeways as their supplier, and they would sell their designs through Shapeways, through a variety of point-of-service operations. And now that part of their livelihood is now fundamentally impossible. And they've been sent scrambling. There are a whole bunch of orders that were in process, but Shapeways just closed up shop and stopped. Apparently, according to some storefront operators, the communication during this process was not very good. The suspicion was that the people who might have been involved in communicating with them had in fact been sacked. So there's that.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, it's the nature of things. So it's a bit of a sad moment for Shapeways and also for the tabletop industry that it impacts.
Yeah, it's sad to see any business close up shop and the people within it have to deal with that.
Yeah.
But then also to see the negative knock on effect that it has on the rest of the community is never nice to see.
It's true. On the topic of the tabletop miniatures community, Jimbo.
So Mark and Walker reported some episodes ago about what I would consider to be almost the end of an era with the end of the X-Wing miniatures game. It's been a fraught few years with the, you know, creation passing from Fantasy Flight to Atomic Mass Games, and then Embracer Group's acquiring of Asmodee, and then subsequently splintering into three groups and dumping all of their debt onto Asmodee. And it looks like Atomic Mass has completely ceased, or rather will be, by the end of the year, completely ceasing production on Star Wars X-Wing and Star Wars Armada. Now, as an Armada player myself, most of us Armada players had seen the writing on the wall some time ago. There hasn't been new content for Armada in quite some time.
Just as a note, I'm a little insulted, or at least I would feel a little insulted, that they just hadn't said anything prior to that. Like, would it have killed them to at least acknowledge that they weren't doing any? Even just... we definitively don't have any plans going forward for Armada. Maybe that'll change. But they couldn't even be bothered to do that.
I completely agree. As an Armada player, it's felt a lot like sort of being the forgotten stepchild.
Yeah.
The particular Star Wars miniature games, which sucks. I'm not happy about it, but I get it. My limited understanding is that Atomic Mass is much more focused on games of the same ilk as Star Wars Legion.
Yeah.
And that's why there was no further content on Armada and somewhat halting content for X-Wing.
Mm-hmm.
But the upside, the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, is that the X-Wing miniatures community has come together to continue to try to push forward the con and the tournament play space going forward for the rest of the year. I believe Adepticon is going to be handled by several of the larger names in the space. Please forgive me, I don't know exactly who it is, and I'm reluctant to call out just one or two when I know that it's a huge undertaking of everyone. And there's even been discussion that at the end of the year, when production officially stops, that these people may begin working on furthering, I don't know about new ships or new content, but, you know, continuing to troubleshoot, continuing to adjust points, continuing to push a tournament play sphere forward, which is great. I'm very happy to hear that. X-Wing was always a bit hit or miss for me personally, but I'm very happy to hear that in some form or another it's going to continue. You know, when it comes to, for example, video games, a good modding community can easily extend the tail of a game a very long time, and hopefully the same thing can happen with X-Wing.
Yeah, I'm hopeful as well. I talked about a while ago how Mike Hutchinson, the designer of Gaslands and A Billion Suns, is fast-tracking some of his rule sets to make use of some of those now less useful X-Wing miniatures. So Gaslands in Space, or things that are close to Gaslands in Space, are very much on the horizon.
Sorry, Gaslands in Space!
My sincere apologies to the space and all the pigs inside of it. But yes, so there is a bit of a future, and indeed a good community can make all the difference in the world for such things. After all, it was the community that first came up with those interesting campaign systems.
Absolutely.
For X-Wing, that then Fantasy Flight, back when it pretended like it cared, then adapted itself into, I think, one of, if not the last supplements.
Yes,
for
agree.
X-Wing. Finally, some Martin Wallace news now. There's going to be some expansions to Bloodstones, but we don't really care about that on this show. And there's going to be a fourth iteration of what originally began as a study in Emerald called Cthulhu Dark Providence. There's a couple of interesting bits of development there. One of them is that now it's going to be in the Death May Die universe, which is weird because the tone of A Study in Emerald was light years away from Death May Die. But we really like the spin that Death May Die takes
very much so
on the Cthulhu mythos. So who knows? That might be good or it might just be nothing. It might just be Simon slapping some paint on it. And the co-development work for this edition is going to be with Travis Chance, who designed Heroes Wanted and Path of Light and Shadow, which both of them, although uneven, I felt, had some really interesting stuff. I read the designer diary of Travis Chance, and he's identified as areas to work on or improve all the things that I don't like about Study of Emerald, so I confess I'm intrigued. So we'll see what happens there. Also, Martin Wallace is going to be designing a game called Casus Belli, which is a sci-fi game with some interesting possible peace and conflict dynamics. Like, you can't go to war with somebody unless there's an actual Casus Belli, and that changes the dynamic of things. Now, this could lead to one of two directions. It could either lead to the direction that I hope it does, which is something feeling a little bit like Successors, where there's this fascinating dynamic of when you choose to go to war, under what circumstances, and paying the prices for that, but liberating yourself thereby. The same thing kind of happened in Triumph and Tragedy, where a declaration of war was absolutely necessary, but painful at times. Or it could lead into a situation where you're just straitjacketed. Like, I really want to fight you, but I can't, so all right. Mm. Or vice versa. So we'll see. But Martin Wallace is an interesting designer, and I look forward to seeing what develops from that. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now we move on to our topic, which is when to go digital. I thought you, Jimbo, would be a good person to tap for this because of your enthusiasm for the Vigigames, as Walker would say, the clickety-clacks. And this is a topic that often comes up when I play games with my friend Josephus. Josephus has a very, very low threshold at which he would say, that was fine, but I'd rather play it on a PC. And so I was wondering what your thoughts were on the topic of when a board game is better served as a digital kind of experience.
It's an interesting talking point because I think it's so dependent on the game in question. Like,
right.
You really can't. At first, there would have been a time where I would have said, okay, so games beyond a certain complexity are always going to benefit from being a digital. The example I'll use is Scythe, for example. So I quite like Scythe. There's a lot of overhead, a lot of moving parts. You know, setup and teardown is not insubstantial.
Okay.
But its digital implementation, I actually don't think added much to it, where I would have originally thought, oh yeah, you know, digital Scythe, this is going to be great. It wasn't bad. Like, it wasn't a bad digital implementation. I don't feel that it took anything away, but the time spent playing only dipped by, I would think, a couple of minutes. What you gain in a potential saving of time is unfortunately lost in a frustrating inability to take back or undo something you didn't mean to do.
Right.
Which is particularly frustrating in a digital format where it might not even be a case of not remembering what it was you had planned to do. It may simply have just been a misclick.
Yeah.
And at least in the Scythe implementation, there is an incredibly frustrating inability to backtrack. On the other side of the coin, the Spirit Island digital implementation, although it took a long time to get to a point that I would consider it to be worthwhile, has an incredibly robust ability to go back in, very granular in your own turn, being able to undo small actions, to being able to request that the table entirely go back to a previous phase. Now, once you've flipped a random card, you can't go back to that point.
Right.
Makes perfect sense to me. And so I definitely refined my look at it, where it's much less of a, games of this complexity should always be digital, and definitely think that more, it really is more dependent on each individual game. Have there been any particular games that you've ever thought, you know, yeah, I really think this would do better as a digital implementation?
Well, I had that vibe very strongly recently when we were playing Iberian Gauge. The last two rounds of Iberian Gauge were very mechanical and just involved a lot of financial transactions that were relatively transparent. And indeed, insofar as there was any decision-making, it was just based on available supplies. It was the kind of thing where the information presentation of a digital version would actually be superior. Because that's one of my key beefs with digital implementations. It's often very difficult to get a bird's eye view of the table state and be able to internalize all the necessary moving parts. Like, I played the side of the digital implementation, and I never felt like I could look at one thing that would tell me everything I needed to know. This wasn't just a question of real estate. It was just a question of how I process information. And the different looking from the board to my player board or whatever, or to the pile of resources in real life is easy. In video games and digital implementations, it's often difficult. But those last two rounds of Iberian Gauge were all about how many trains are left, how much money is in the treasury, and how much money will be added if I do this, how much money will be detracted if I do that. And I completely understood why a lot of people that are hardcore in the 18XX community and a whole bunch of hardcore trading gamers usually at some point they're like, all right, we're just going to spreadsheet this. There are spreadsheets where they're like, okay, we're not really playing the game anymore. We're now just going to input all the numbers into a spreadsheet, and it's going to spit out what all the dividends are and what the payouts are and what all the thresholds are there. And I completely understand why people do that.
Absolutely.
Even in simpler games. I'm not suggesting that I want to do that as well, but even simple games, sometimes it's weird. What I want automated and what I don't want automated is, of course, a very personal choice. Like, for example, in Sentinels of the Multiverse, I had no difficulty understanding the virtue of a Sentinels of the Multiverse app. Mm-hmm. Because of all the, you know, this targets the non-hero target with the second lowest HP. Give me a break. And that's completely why a number of people bounce off and prefer the Sentinels digital implementation. And this is despite the fact that Sentinels as a game is very simple. I mean, that's why I brought it, after all. Its simplicity was one of its assets. So whether a game is very complicated, like an 18XX game, or very simple, like Iberian Gauge, or Sentinels of the Multiverse, there can be things that I desperately want automated. The problem is that there's this, as you say, it's a very fine line between what I want super transparent and what I want opaque and or managed by a machine, because there's an opacity once you hand it over to a machine.
Absolutely. To use the Sentinels of the Multiverse example, it absolutely automates all of those. You know, okay, so the boss plays this card. This causes them to play another card, which causes them to go through their deck and find a card,
right,
which then necessitates their deck to be shuffled, which then allows them to play another card, which is great. Having all that automated is great. But then there is frequently a very long pause as we all look back over the game log to go, okay, wait, what just happened?
Whereas, and what do I do about all these cards that just entered play?
Exactly. Whereas if someone is going through it, it's being explained as it's happening. And although that may technically on the surface take more time, mm-hmm, without needing that, okay, what just happened turn,
yeah,
it actually mostly seems to end up taking less time. The Sentinels app was relatively well done. There are some strange oversights, again, mostly in results of being able to go back or being able to respond to things. I agree. The opacity that gets added can really undermine it. Like, you can take a relatively simple game like Sentinels, where someone can say, okay, what just happened? And then someone says, oh, okay, well, so this, and this.
Yep.
This is what led to this. And everybody goes, oh, okay. Whereas the app will fling them at you super fast, and someone goes, what just happened? And the most frequent answer is, I have no idea.
App assistance also sometimes runs afoul of this in a variety of ways. Again, looking at Sentinels, a lot of people, and indeed your group did this primarily before some jerk came in from Montreal and said you should stop, used the tracker app.
Yes.
You didn't do the digital version, but playing in person, you played with the cards, and you used entirely the tracker app. And there, it's a question of pick your poison, because the tracker app will easily identify, you know, again, the non-hero target with the second highest HP or second lowest HP or whatever. Then you have a number of choices. Number one, how many screens do you have this operating on? Then you have to worry about all those screens agreeing, which they seldom do, because there's a lot of small transactions, and the moment there is multiples, the chance of being, I don't mind if there are errors, so long as it's consistent, right? If we're all tracking with tokens, we're going to make mistakes.
Absolutely.
We're all going to have the same record, and it's immediately visible to everybody. Alternatively, you can just do it on one tracker, in which case you're not really tracking at all, because you're constantly asking the same person, wait, what's going on? Like, if we had a dedicated setup, like in the vision, where some billionaire like Harlan Crow decides that what he wants to do is not buy a Supreme Court justice, but instead wants to buy a board gaming podcast. You know, we have a conference room with a giant ass screen that's cast
absolutely
up there. That'd be great. Then I'd happily use tracker apps.
Yeah, but when you're passing one iPad around or one Surface or one whatever around the table, it's either being passed around the table, which is in its own way disruptive. If you're handling your own hand of cards, you don't want to suddenly be handed a larger piece of technology.
Yep.
And as you said, then you're in this weird situation where you're like, oh, can I see the iPad? Or you're asking a question that otherwise would be able to identify. When we first swapped, I pined for the simplicity of the tracker app. Since then, I have fully embraced the tokens. I prefer the tokens. Literally, the only thing about the app at this point that I miss is the easy who has the highest, who has the lowest.
Yeah.
Because frequently when it's, we're getting better, but frequently when it's who has the highest, there's pause. And then someone says, oh, well, I have 23. And that gets everyone else to, oh, well, I have 27. I have
sure
whatever. And that extra time can sometimes be like, can't answer this question sure. if we don't all chime in.
I will say, though, in context like that, it is useful to just have a check-in moment where I get to hear everyone's hit point values.
Very much
there's so. There's a certain use to that.
And unfortunately, app-assisted games also then leads into app-driven games.
Yeah.
And more and more, with actually the most recent exception of Fateforge.
Yes.
More and more, I am finding that either, and then I'm generalizing, so if you work in the industry, please don't take offense, the effort that goes into maintaining the app side is not commensurate with the effort that goes into creating the board game itself.
Mm.
We have struggled to get my father's work back to the table because the three times we have brought it to the table, the app has crashed.
Yeah.
And there has been no save. There's been no quick save, no autosave. There's been no way to recover lost process. And in at least two occasions, it was close enough to the beginning that we could have just started again clicking through. But by that point, people are just frustrated.
Yeah.
For one of them, it was me, where I just said, I'm really just not interested in...
Yeah.
In doing this again.
I wouldn't necessarily put it in terms of effort. I would just put it in terms of the level of polish isn't at the same level.
That's a much better way to put it, yeah.
And look, it's a high bar. It's difficult, but it is what it is. Now, it's interesting you bring up Fateforge because this is actually something I've been thinking about. Have you played the PC game Wildermyth?
Yes.
So here's the thing that Wildermyth and I think Fateforge are kind of on the same page about, because Wildermyth is a grid-based tactical squad combat game, which I think could be easily adapted to tabletop if you were inclined.
I think so.
There's not a whole heck of a lot going on when you compare it to a lot of other tactical grid-based things on the PC. Like, for example, some of the weirder stuff that happens during a game of XCOM, the weirder stuff that happens during, say, The Last Spell, which I know you play. You know, the weird sort of compounding, it's like, well, this is 5% of that, and this is 7% of this other thing, and there's a 6% chance of burning at this point.
Yep.
You know, all those things where PC games and digital games lean into their strengths that would not work for tabletop. I'll have more to say about that later in the context of roguelites like Risk of Rain and Dead Cells and One Deck Dungeon. And Wildermyth, though, where what it does do and what it renders completely opaque, which is good, is the storytelling.
Yes.
You don't know where the story's going. You don't know what levers you're pulling will influence the story and which ones won't. You don't know if that side mission will influence the story or if it won't. You just don't know. And that level of uncertainty and opacity would be unacceptable to me in the tactical screen. But in the context of the narrative screen is exactly what I want.
Absolutely.
And Fateforge sometimes gets there.
Completely agree.
The combat is mostly transparent. Sometimes the enemies will react in somewhat unanticipated ways, but that's AI is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the expectation and the knowledge that the app is tracking things in the back end. If you remember back when we were knee-deep in some of our campaigns of Kingdom Death Monster, just the reams of notes that we would keep.
Absolutely.
That were then impossible to keep track of. Who's the son of who did what to when? And like, oh, that was an interesting thing that happened. Can we remember it? It's like, well, not documentary, but... And that is what I want app management to do. The numbers, ideally, pretty much to any level of complexity, I want to be in charge of. But when it comes to managing the overall paperwork, the broader aspect of that, anything that's accounting rather than gameplay decision, I realize I'm contradicting myself, but there's a distinction I'm trying to draw. I'm happy when apps take care of that. Now, that having been said, I agree with you. App-driven games are an entire minefield. That's an entire separate topic that we've talked about at length on the mm-hmm. podcast. But that's the kind of thing that makes me feel like, why am I doing this in a pen and paper context? If I want a good story to be managed for me, I think that a digital version could do it better.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And Wildermyth is a great example of exactly that. I adore Wildermyth. I'm completely in love with it. And I think it would make a great board game. Precisely because, like you said, all the mechanical stuff you're in charge of, you know exactly what you're doing, what you know, how you're doing it, when it happens.
But that's my point. I don't think it needs to be a board game.
Yeah.
Like adapting Wildermyth. Now, I've been wrong about this a lot. I said the same thing about Slay the Spire, and my mind is in the process of being changed. But Wildermyth, I'm more responding to some of the people who play Wildermyth, and I've heard this complaint. Oh, but the combat is too simple. It's like, yeah, sure, fine. I mean, you could dress it up with more stuff if you wanted to.
Yeah, I suppose.
But that's not why it's a digital thing. It's a digital thing, and it's playing to its strengths because of all the back-end stuff that you're not seeing.
Yeah.
I'm willing to play a perfectly transparent, relatively simple tactical thing on a PC. I'm also willing to play a more Baroque thing, which actually leads to some of my favorite PC games are roguelites. Like Risk of Rain, like Dead Cells, like Slay of the Spire. And what they do is, Risk of Rain is a particularly good example of this. I don't think that Risk of Rain could ever be adapted to a board game the way I want it to.
I don't even know how you'd begin.
Yeah, because everything you pick up has this concatenating series of like percentile proc chances and weird modifiers and status effects and outre things. Like it's just endless. And that's just how it's designed. It's an action platformer. When you pull the trigger, you don't have to know the precise chance of the 12 stacked modifiers that you have proccing individually or combining with the other 17 modifiers that work on the back end. And that's fine, right? It's an action platformer. Dead Cells, on the other hand, is a much simpler universe of modifiers, generally speaking. That having been said, the adaptation of board games looks weird. I pledge for it. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to have just mostly avoided a lot of the roguelike trappings in terms of the differentiation of modifiers and more just, well, keep trying the level until you get it right. You can die as many times as you want in the process.
Interesting. More of a puzzle.
Yeah, well, more just when you're adapting a game, you decide what notes you want to hit and what notes you don't, and you know the different kinds of special abilities and weird, like for example, when playing Dead Cells, you might pick up a bow that has a 5% chance of inflicting a status effect, but that's like you can strip that part out, and you don't feel like you're missing the central part of what makes Dead Cells Dead Cells.
True.
I don't think you could quite say the same for something like Risk of Rain. The only board game I played, for what it's worth, that really sought to leverage this weird set of, well, you're just going to have a different universe of you know, a dozen different modifiers, is One Deck Dungeon, which is a very, very simple game designed by a friend of mine, admittedly. But you just get a whole bunch of different potions that all come on the different monster cards, and so there's a ton of variety, a whole bunch of different skills that you can trigger, again, that key off of monster cards. And, you know, every run feels demonstrably different as a consequence. When it comes to things like Slay the Spire, again, I'm going to have more to say about this the more I talk about Slay the Spire, but the comparison of how they leaned on different things is fascinating, right? In the digital version, there are too many modifiers to track. The math involved, you know, the way weak interacts with vulnerable, with strength and poison 17 that ticks down to 16 and so forth, that wouldn't work in a board game. And so consequently, they just flattened the universe of modifiers in the board game, leading to a very similar but also very different experience. And so again, I think that there are strengths to each version, and you really have to play to that. I applaud the fact that trained gamers and 18xx gamers, over the course of a single session, are expected to recognize, okay, time to take this to the computer.
Yeah, we're moving to the point now where it's just going to be so much easier to do this. With some digital assistance.
Yeah, and it's impressive. They do it, I've seen it happen a number of times, they do it as a rule far more smoothly than I've seen anybody, for example, interface the digital analog divide when playing Sentinels of the Multiverse, as an example, right? Like,
yep.
There, the confusion, like, you're constantly shifting attention, whereas the train gamer is like, all right, I'm busting out the laptop, tackety, tackety, tackety. Oh, you're actually building track? Okay, where's it going? All right, tackety, tackety. And it's like I said, train gamers are an impressive breed. What can I say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like maybe the... It sounds like a lot of the 18xx games could benefit from either a full digital implementation or some kind of digital assistant, like mm-hmm. when they bring out the laptop and the spreadsheets. What that thought that led me into is, of course, the sensation, the feeling of it. Just because an 18xx game would benefit from a digital implementation doesn't mean that people that play it want to do it that
way.
I really enjoy the Spirit Island digital implementation. I still vastly prefer to get together and play it in person.
Yeah.
I mostly enjoy the Sentinels, the Multiverse digital experience.
Mm-hmm.
I would still prefer to get together and play it in person. I'm enjoying the digital version of Gaia Project that I'm playing now. I'd still prefer to get together and play it in person.
Yep. I wish one other thing about, you know, when to go digital and how to lean into the strengths of digital versions. It's unfortunate, completely understandable, but unfortunate that we don't have a market that's big enough to allow the visuals to really go to town. Like, when I think about the volume of art assets that Sentinels of the Multiverse already has, And if they had really, like, with an unlimited budget and a large enough audience, just what they could have done visually with the digital implementation of Sentinels, it makes me a little sad.
Agreed.
Some implementations get close, like Roots adaptation does a pretty good job with a lot of the Kyle Farron visuals, and it's awfully charming, and that's great. But alas, because that again is something you can really try to take. This is why I appreciate when a designer really looks to the strength of the medium and really leverages that strength. And going hog with some of the visuals is one of the things that you could do in an incredibly well-funded digital version. I understand why it doesn't exist in the board game space, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you for joining me, Jimbo. I appreciate it a great deal.
Thank you very much for having me.
We hope to see you again soon. Please take care of your hobby. Please take care of your health. And remember to thank your Rules Explainer. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Big. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.